Elon Musk, great to see you. How are you?
Good, how are you?
I mean, we're here at the Texas Gigafactory the day before this thing opens. It's been pretty crazy out there. Thank you so much for making the time.
Hey, what? See that?
I would love you to help us cast our minds 10, 20, maybe 30 years into the future. And help us try to picture what it would take to build a future that's worth getting excited about. You've often said that the last time you spoke at me, you said that was really just a big driver. You know, you talk about lots of other reasons to do what you're doing, but fundamentally, you want to think about the future and not think of the sucks.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in general, there's a lot of discussion of like this problem, that problem. A lot of people are sad about the future, and they're pessimistic. And I think this is not great. I mean, we really want to wake up in the morning and look forward to the future. We want to be excited about what's going to happen. Mm. And life cannot simply be about solving one miserable problem after another.
So if you look forward 30 years, you know, this year, the year 2050 has been labeled by scientists as this kind of, almost like this doomsday deadline on climate. There's a consensus of scientists, like a large consensus of scientists, who believe that if we haven't completely eliminated greenhouse gases or offset them completely by 2050, effectively we're inviting climate catastrophe. Do you believe there is a pathway to avoid that catastrophe? What would it look like?
I am not one of the doomsday people, because I actually think we're on a good path. But at the same time, I think we're pushing against complacency. So long as we are not complacent, as long as we have a high sense of urgency about moving for a sustainable energy economy, then I think things will be fine. So I can't emphasize it enough. So long as we push hard and not complacent, the future's going to be better. Don't worry about it. I mean, worry about it, but if you worry about it, ironically, it will be a self-unfulfilling prophecy. There are three elements to a sustainable energy future. One is sustainable energy generation, which is primarily wind and solar, hydro, geothermal, I'm actually probably doing but it's going to be primarily solar and wind as these primary generators of energy. The second part is you need batteries to store the solar and wind energy, because the sun doesn't shine all the time, the wind is low. So you need a lot of stationary battery packs. And then you need energy transport. So like your cars, like planes, boats. And then, it's not really possible to make electric rockets, but you can make propellant in rockets using sustainable energy.
Right.
So, ultimately, we can have a fully sustainable energy economy, and it's those three things: solar, wind, stationary battery pack, electric vehicles. So then, what are the limiting factors on progress? The limiting factor really would be battery cell production. So that's gonna really be the fundamental rate driver, and then whatever the slowest element of the whole lithium-ion battery cells supply chain for mining, and many steps in the mining within the battery cell, into a pack, that will be the limiting factor on progress towards.
All right. So we need to talk more about batteries, because the key thing that I want to consider, right, there seems to be a scaling issue here. Is kind of amazing and alarming. You have said that you have calculated that the amount of battery production that the world needs for sustainability is 300 terawatt hours of battery.
If that's the
end goal.
Very rough numbers, and I certainly would invite others to check our calculations, because they arrive at a different conclusion. But in order to transition, not just electricity production, also diesel and transport. which roughly triples the amount of electricity that you need. It amounts to approximately 300 kilowatt hours of installed capacity.
So we need to give people a sense of how big a task that is. I mean, here we are, the Gigafactory. You know, this is one of the biggest buildings in the world. What I've read, and tell me if this is still right, is that the goal here is to eventually produce 100 gigawatt hours of batteries a year.
We'll probably do more than that, but yes, that's, hopefully we get there within a couple of years.
Right. But I mean, that is
one point one terawatt hours.
But that's still 1/100 of what's needed. How much of the rest of that 100 is Tesla planning to take on between now and 2030, 2040, when we really need to see the scale up happen?
I mean, these are just guesses. I mean, so please, you know, people shouldn't hold me to these things. It's not like this is like some. What does happen is I'll make some, like, you know, best guess, and then people will. 5 years will be some of the right smart book. Elon said this would happen, and it didn't happen. He's a liar and a fool. It's very annoying when that happens. So these are just guesses. This is a conversation. I think Tesla probably ends up doing 10% of that. Right.
Let's say 2050. We have this amazing, you know, 100% sustainable electric grid made up of, you know, some mixture of the sustainable energy sources you talked about. That same grid probably is offering the world really low cost energy, isn't it, compared with now?
Yeah.
And I'm curious about, like, should people entitled to get a little bit excited about the possibilities of that world?
People should be optimistic about the future. Humanity will solve sustainable energy. It will happen. If we are, you know, continue to push hard, the future is bright and good from an energy standpoint. And then it will be possible to use that energy to do carbon sequestration. It takes a lot of energy to pull carbon out of the atmosphere, just as because in putting it in the atmosphere, it releases energy. So now, you know, obviously in order to pull it out, you need to use a lot of energy, but we've got a lot of sustainable energy from wind and solar. You can actually use sequester carbon, so you can reverse the CO2 you can much more in the atmosphere and oceans. And also, you can really have as much fresh water as you want. Earth is mostly water. We should call Earth water. It's 70% water by subsurface. Now, most of that's seawater, but we just have to be able to put that land.
Right. and with energy, you can turn seawater into.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
At very low cost. Things will be good.
Things will be good.
Yes.
And also, there's not the benefits, right, from this non-fossil fuel world where the air is cleaner.
Yes, exactly. Because, like when you burn fossil fuels, there's all these, like, side reactions and toxic gases of various kinds. And that's, like, particulates that are bad for your lungs. Like, there's all sorts of bad things that are happening that will go away. Okay. And the sky will be cleaner and quieter. The future's going to be good.
I want us to switch now to think a bit about artificial intelligence. But the segue there, you mentioned how annoying it is people calling about bad predictions in the past. So I'm possibly going to be annoying now. But I'm curious about your timelines and how you predict and how come some things are so amazingly annoying in some parts. So, when it comes to predicting sales of Tesla vehicles, for example, I mean, you find it amazing. I think in 2014, when Tesla had sold that year 60,000 cars, you said 2020, I think you would do 500,000
vehicles. It almost exactly happened.
You did almost exactly happen. You were stopped in 2014 because no one since Henry Ford with the Model T had come close to that kind of growth rate for cars. You were stopped and you actually hit 500,000 cars.
Yeah.
510,000 cars. But 5 years ago, last time you came to there, I asked you about full self-driving. And you said, yep, this very year, I am confident that we will have a car going from LA to New York without any intervention.
Yeah, I don't want to blow your mind, but I'm not always right.
So talk, what's the difference between those two? Why does full self-driving so hard to
do? I mean, the thing that really got me, and I think it's going to get a lot of other people, is that there are just so many false dawns with self-driving, where you think you've got a problem ahead of having a problem, and then it turns out you just hit a ceiling. Because what happened, if you were to plot the progress, the progress looks like a log curve. So it's like a series of log curves. So, first of all, I would like to make this one, but it goes up sort of a fairly straight way, and then it starts tailing off, and you start getting diminishing returns. And you're like, it was trending up, and now it's sort of curving over and up, and you start getting to these what I call local maxima, where you don't realize basically how dumb you are. And then it happens again. So. These things, in retrospect, they seem obvious, but in order to solve full self-driving properly, you have to solve real-world AI. What are the road networks designed to work with? They're designed to work with a biological neural net, our brains, and with vision, our eyes. And so, in order to make it work, computers, you basically need to solve real-world AI and vision. Because we need cameras and silicon neural nets in order to have self-driving work for a system that was designed for eyes and biological neural nets. When you put it that way, it's sort of quite obvious that the only way to solve for self-driving is to solve real-world AI and sophisticated vision.
What do you feel about the current architecture? Do you think you have an architecture now where there is a chance for the logarithmic curve not to tail off any time soon?
Well, I mean, inevitably these may be an infamous last words, but I actually am confident that we'll solve this year. That we will receive, what's the probability of an accident, what point do you exceed that of the average person? I think we will exceed that this year.
What are you seeing behind the scenes that gives you that confidence?
We're almost at the point where we have a high-quality unified vector space. Like in the beginning, we were trying to do this with image recognition on individual images. But if you look at one image out of a video, it's actually quite hard to see what's going on with that ambiguity. But if you look at a video segment, a few seconds of video, that ambiguity resolves. So the first thing we have to do is sort of tie all eight cameras together so they're synchronized. So all the frames are looked at simultaneously and labeled simultaneously by one person. So we still need to label them. So at least they're not labeled at different times by different people in different ways, and it's sort of a surround picture. Then a very important part is to add the time dimension, so that you're looking at surround video, and you're labeling surround video, this is actually quite difficult to do from a software standpoint. We have to write our own labeling tools, and then. Create order labeling software to amplify the efficiency of human labelers, because it's quite hard to label video. In the beginning, it was taking several hours to label a 10-second video clip. This is not stable.
Right.
So basically, what you have to have is you have to have surround video, and that surround video has to be primarily automatically labeled for humans just being editors and making slight corrections to the labeling video. Feeding back those corrections into the future auto labeler, so you get this flywheel eventually where the auto labeler is able to take in that last video and with high accuracy automatically label the video for cars, lane lines, drive space.
What you're saying is that you think that when the result of this is that you're effectively giving the car a 3D model of the actual object are all around it. It knows what they are. It knows how fast they are moving. And the remaining task is to is to predict what the quirky behaviors are that you know, that when a pedestrian is walking down the road with a smaller pedestrian, that maybe that smaller pedestrian might do something predictable or things like that. That you have to build into it before you can really call it safe.
You basically you need to have memory across time and space. So what I mean by that is. If you, because you can't, the memory can't be infinite because it's using up a lot of computers RAM. So you have to say how much are you going to try to remember. It's very common for things to be occluded. So like if you're about, say, a pedestrian walking past a truck where you saw the pedestrian start on one side of the truck, then they're occluded by the truck. You would know intuitively, okay, that pressure is going to pop out the other side, most likely. And
the computer doesn't know.
So you need to slow down.
I mean, a skeptic is going to say that every year for the last 5 years, you've kind of said, well, oh, this is the year. Well, I mean, we're confident that it will be there in a year or two. Or, you know, like it's always been about that far away. But you've got a new architecture now. You're seeing enough improvement behind the scenes. You're not certain, but pretty confident. By the end of this year, not in every city, in every circumstance, but in many cities and circumstances, basically, I will be able to drive without interventions safely in the field.
Yes, I mean, the car currently drives me around Austin most of the time with no interventions. So it's not like, and we have over 100,000 people in our driving vehicle. So you can look at the videos that they post online. Okay, great. And
some of them are great, and some of them are a little terrifying. I mean, occasionally, the car seems to sort of like veer off and scare the hell out of people. But you're behind the scenes looking at it, you're seeing enough improvement to believe that you see it.
Yes, that's what it seems like. I mean, I'd like to for people here. Again, and it's like, well, yet another year went by and it didn't happen. But I think this is the year.
And so, in general, when people talk about Elon time, it sounds like you can't just have a general rule that if you predict that something will be done in 6 months, actually, what you should imagine is it's going to be a year. It's like 2x predict. It depends on the type of prediction. Some things, I guess, things involving software, AI, whatever, are fundamentally harder to predict than others. Is there an element that you actually deliberately make aggressive prediction timelines to drive people to be ambitious? Without that, nothing gets done.
Well, I generally believe, in terms of internal timelines, that we want to set the most aggressive timeline that we can. Because there's still like the law of gas expansion where your schedules, where whatever time you set, it's not going to be less than that. It's very rare that it'll be less than that. And as far as my predictions are concerned, what tends to happen in the media is that they will report all the wrong ones and ignore all the right ones. When writing an article about me, I've had a long career in multiple industries. If you list my sins, I sound like the worst person on earth. But if you put those against things I've done right, it makes much more sense. So essentially, like the longer you do anything, the more mistakes that you will make cumulatively, which if you sum up those mistakes, will sound like I'm the worst predictor ever. But for example, for the Tesla vehicle growth, I said I think we'll do 50%, and we've done 80%. But they don't mention that. I'm not sure what my exact track record is on predictions. They're more optimistic than pessimistic, but they're not all optimistic. Some of them are exceeded, probably more are later. But they do come through. It's very rare that they do come through. It's sort of like if there's some radical technology prediction, the point is not that it was a few years late that it happened at all. that's the more important part.
it feels like at some point in the last year, seeing the progress on understanding is that you're. that the AI, the Tesla AI, understanding the world around it, led to a kind of an aha moment. Because you really surprised people recently when you said, probably the most important product development going on in Tesla this year is this robot Optimus.
Yeah.
Many companies out there tried to put out the robots and worked on them for years. And so far, no one has really cracked it. There's no mass adoption robot in people's homes. There are some in manufacturing, but I would say no one's really cracked it. What is it, something that happened in the development of course that's driving that gave you the confidence to say, you know what, we can do something special?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it took me a while to sort of realize this, that in order to solve self-driving, you really need to solve the world AI. And the point at which you solve the world AI for a car, which is really a robot on four wheels, you can then generalize that to a robot on legs as well. The two hard parts, I think, like it's not, obviously companies like Boston Dynamics have shown that it's possible to make quite compelling solutions for long-range robots.
Right.
From a sensors and actuator standpoint, it's certainly been demonstrated by many that are robot. The things that are currently missing are enough intelligence for a robot to navigate through the world and use things without being explicitly instructed. So the missing things are basically real world intelligence and scaling of manufacturing. Those are two things that Tesla is very good at. You basically just need to design the specialized actuators and sensors that are needed for the roadmap. People have no idea. This is going to be bigger than the car.
So let's dig into exactly that. And in one way, it's actually easier problem than full-self driving, because instead of an object going along 60 miles an hour, which
yeah.
it gets along with some of the time, this is an object that's engineered to only go up about 2 or 4 or 5 miles
yeah,
an hour.
Yeah, walking speed.
And so a mistake, is it, there aren't lives at stake. There might be embarrassment at stake.
As long as the AI doesn't take it over and
right.
Murder us nicely.
Right. So talk about, I mean, the first applications you've mentioned are probably going to be manufacturing, but eventually the vision is to have these available for people at home.
Right? Yeah.
If you had a robot that really understood the 3D architecture of your house and knew where every object in that house was or was supposed to be and could recognize all those objects, Like that kind of thing that you could ask a robot to do would be what? Like, tidy up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or
make dinner, move along.
Take a cup of tea to grandma and show her family
absolutely.
Pictures.
Exactly, take her grandmother and make sure, exactly.
When it could recognize everyone in the home.
Yeah.
Play catch with your kids.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we need to be careful that this doesn't disturb the situation. I think one of the things that's going to be important is to have full advisor on the car, the robot that cannot be updated over there. Where, if you, for example, would say stop, then if anyone said that, then the robot would stop. And that's not updated for the moment. I think it's going to be important to have safety.
That sounds wise.
And I do think there should be a regulatory agency for AI. I've said this for many years. I don't love being regulated, but I think this is an important thing for politics.
Let's come back to that. I don't think many people have really sort of taken seriously the notion of, a robot.
Right.
I mean, at the start of the computer revolution, Bill Gates said, "There's a computer in every home," and people at the time said, "Yeah, whatever. Who would even want that?"
Don't have a computer in our pocket.
Do you think there will be this? Safe robot in most homes is what they will be, and people
think they probably
will. You'll have your own butler, basically.
Yeah, you'll have your sort of buddy robot, probably. Yeah.
I mean, how much of a buddy? How many applications have you got? Is there, you have a romantic partner, sex partner?
I mean,
love
it's probably inevitable. I mean, I did promise the internet that I'd make cat girls who would have a robot. I guess it'll be what whatever people want, really.
What sort of timeline should we be thinking about the first models that are actually made and sold.
Well, you know, the first units that we've been made are for jobs that are dangerous, boring, competitive, and things that people don't want to do. And, you know, I think we'll have, like, an interesting prototype sometime this year. We might have something useful next year, but I think quite likely to be just 2 years. And then we'll see rapid growth here for the useful system to work on this.
Initially, just selling to businesses, or when yeah. Did you picture you'll sell your start selling them when you can buy your parents one of the businesses?
It's yeah, less than 10 years.
Yeah. Help me on the economics of this. So, what do you picture the cost of hundreds to be?
Well, I think the cost is actually not going to be really crazy high. Like less than a car. Initially, things will be expensive because it'll be new technology or a bunch of money. The complexity of cost of a car is greater than that of a commercial car. So, I would expect that it's going to be less than a car, or at least equivalent to a cheap car.
So, even if it starts at 50k, then in a few years it's down to 20k or lower. And maybe for home they'll get much cheaper still. But think about the economics of it. If you can replace a $30,000, $40,000 a year worker, which you have to pay every year, with a one-time payment of $25,000 for a robot to work longer hours, a pretty rapid replacement of certain types of jobs, how worried should the world be about that?
I wouldn't worry about the sort of critical part of the jobs. We're actually going to have, and already do have, a massive shortage of labor. So I think we will have not people out of work, but actually still a shortage of labor even in the future. This really will be a world of abundance. Any goods and services will be available to anyone who wants them. It will be so cheap that the goods and services will be ridiculous.
And presumably it should be possible to imagine a bunch of goods and services that can't possibly be made now, could be made in that world because of using robots.
Yeah, it will be a world of abundance. But the only scarcity that will exist in the future is that which we decide to create ourselves and consume.
Okay, so AI is allowing us to imagine a differently powered economy that creates money. What are you most worried about?
Well, like I said, AI and robotics will bring on what might be termed the age of abundance of the future. And that this is my prediction of the future for everyone. I guess there's the dangers would be the artificial general intelligence with visual superintendents. Decouples from the human world goes in the direction that somebody would like. The idea of the neural link is kind of more tightly coupled than the human world to the digital and also along the way, sort of like the brain measurements and plan. Even if it doesn't succeed in the grid quality, it's sort of like it succeed in the role of media, the brain is going to
happen. So the spirit there is that if we're going to make these AIs so vastly intelligent, we ought to be more directly driven so that we ourselves can have those superpowers more directly. But that doesn't seem to avoid the risk that those superpowers might turn ugly in an unintended way.
No, I think it's a risk. I agree. I'm not saying that I have some certain answer to that risk. I'm just saying that maybe one of the things that can be good for ensuring that the future is the one that we want is to more tightly couple human world collectively to digital intelligence. But the issue that we face, you know, that we're already deciding, the computers are an extension of ourselves. When we die, basically, we have to deal with ghosts, or like text messages, social media, email, and so on. it's quite eerie, actually, when Sam dies and everything online is still there. But you say, like, what's the limitation? What is it that inhibits human machines and viruses? It's the data. When you communicate, especially with a phone, you're moving your thumbs very slowly, so you're moving the 2 millimeters that at a rate that's maybe 10 bits per second, optimistically 100 bits per second. And computers are communicating at the gigabit.
Have you seen evidence that the technology is actually working? You've got a richer, sort of higher bandwidth connection to light between the external electronics and the brain than has been possible before?
The fundamental principles of reading neurons, during rewrite on neurons with tiny electrodes, have been demonstrated for decades. It's not like this is a concept that's new. The problem is that there's no product that works well that you can go and buy. So it's all sort of in research lines, like those words like some cord sticking out of your head, and it's quite gruesome, and it's really there's no good product that actually does the job and is high bandwidth and safe and something you actually that you could buy and want to buy. So but in it, the way you think of the neural device is kind of like a Fitbit or an Apple Watch where we take out a sort of a small section of skull about the size of a quarter, replace that with what in many ways really is very much like an Apple Watch or some kind of smartwatch thing. And with tiny wires, very, very tiny wires, wires so tiny it's hard to even see them. And it's very important to have very tiny wires that you, when they're implanted, they don't damage the brain.
How far are you from putting them?
We have put in our FDA application aspiration to do the first time.
The first uses will be for neurological invasive compliance.
Yeah.
What are the top four? Imagine when people are actually using these for their own enhancement, let's say, how clear are you in your mind as to what it will feel like inside?
Well, I do want to emphasize we're at an early stage, and so it really will be many years before we have anything approximating high bandwidth interface that allows for AI and viruses. And for many years, we will just be solving brain injury problems, probably better. And this is not something that will suddenly, one day, it will have this incredible whole brain interface. It's going to be, like I said, at least a decade of really just solving brain injuries and injuries. And really, I think it can solve a very wide range. Depression, sleep, schizophrenia, like a lot of things that cause great stress to people, restoring memory in older people.
If you can pull that off, that's the app I will send you. I'm sorry.
Yeah. the emails that we get at Neuralink are heartbreaking. Tragic, but you know where someone was in the prime of life and had an accident or a motorcycle, and someone who's 25 can't even feel themselves. And this is something we can fix.
But you have said that AI is one of the things that we're worried about, and that Neuralink may be one of the ways where we can keep abreast of it.
The short-term thing, which I think is helpful on an individual human level with injuries, and the long-term thing is an attempt to address the civilizational risk of AI by putting digital intelligence, biological intelligence, pieces together. I mean, if you think of how they work today, they're really the two layers of the brain. It's the limbic system, the cortex, the animal brain, whatever. It's kind of like the fun part of it. I think like Tim Rogan said, it's like we're like somebody's stuck a computer on a monkey. We're like if you gave a monkey a computer, that's our cortex. But we still have a lot of monkey instincts.
Right.
So, which we then try to rationalize. It's not a monkey instinct. It's something more important. But it's not just really a monkey instinct. We're just monkeys with a computer stuff. But even though the cortex is sort of the smart or the intelligent part of the brain, the thinking part of the brain, people are quite, I've not yet met anyone who wants to dilute their limbic system or their cortex. They're quite happy having both. Everyone wants both parts of their brain. And people really want their phones and their computers, which are really the tertiary, the third part of computer intelligence. Just that it's like sort of the bandwidth, the rate of communication with that particular layer is slow, and it's just a very tiny scroll to this tertiary layer, and you want to make that tiny scroll a big category. I'm definitely not saying that this is going to solve everything, or this is, it's the only thing, it's something that might be helpful. And worst case scenario, I think we solve some important brain injury, brain injury issues, and that's still a gray area.
Right. Best case scenario, we may discover new human possibility, telepathy you've spoken of, connection with a loved one, full memory, and much faster thought processing. Very cool. If AI were to take down that's shift our attention to space. We spoke last time about reusability, and you just demonstrated that spectacularly last time. Since then, we've gone on to build this monster rocket stuff, which kind of changes the rules of the game in spectacular ways. Tell us about Starship.
Yeah. Starship is extremely fundamental. So the holy grail of rocketry, space transport, is full enough to be useful. This is another thing. Closest that anything's come is our Falcon 9 rocket, where we're able to recover the first stage of the boost limit, which is probably about 60% of the vehicle on the whole launch. I think it's 70%. And we've now done that over 100 times. So with Starship, we will be recovering and moreover, recovering it in such a way that it can be immediately deployed. Whereas with Falcon 9, we still need to do some amount of refurbishment to the boost rail to get prepared for this going. So with Starship, the design goal is immediate refurb.
Right.
So you just refurb the balance and go again. And this is gigantic. It just as it would be in any other mode of transport.
And the main design is to basically take 100 plus people at a time, plus a bunch of things that they need, to Mars. So first of all, talk about that. What is your latest timeline? One, for the first time Starship goes to Mars, presumably without people participating. Two, with people. Three, we're sort of, 100 people at a time, that's the cool stuff.
Sure. And just to put the cost thing into perspective, the cost of, the expected cost of Starship putting 100 tons into orbit is significantly less than what it would have cost, or what it did cost to put our tiny Falcon 1 rocket into orbit. Just as the cost of flying a 747 around the world is less than the cost of a smaller, a smaller kind of star. So it's really pretty mind-boggling how this giant thing costs way less than this planet. So it doesn't use sort of exotic propellants or things that are difficult to obtain on Mars. It uses methane, fuel, it's primarily oxygen, so sort of 70%, 78% oxygen by weight. And Mars atmosphere, the atmosphere, and there's water ice, which is CO2 plus H2O, so you can make CH4 and O2 upstream on Mars.
Presumably one of the first tasks on Mars will be to create a fuel plant and create the fuel for the threat itself in the study.
Yes, and actually, it's mostly going to be an oxygen plant, but it's 78% oxygen, 22% fuel. But the fuel is a simple fuel that is easy to create on Mars, and held up in many other parts of the solar system. So basically, it's all propulsive landing, no parachutes, nothing thrown away. It has heat shields that's capable of entering the Earth, Mars. We even potentially go to Venus. Well, you don't want to go there. No. Venus is hell, almost likely. But you could. It's a generalized method of transport to anywhere in the solar system. Just the point at which I would propel people on Mars and then travel to the asteroid belt and to Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, and ultimately anywhere in the solar system.
Right. But your main purpose is still Mars. Like that is the mission. That is where most of the will go. Are you actually imagining a much broader array of uses, even in the coming, first decade or so of uses of this? Where we could go, for example, to other places in the solar system to explore, perhaps NASA wants to use the rocket for that and use it.
Yeah, NASA is planning to use a Starship to return to the moon, so we're on a planet that has those instructions to do this. I'm saying it's a general solution to getting anywhere in the greater solar system. It's not suitable for going to another star system, but it is a star station for transport anywhere in the solar system.
Before it can do any of that, it's got to demonstrate it can get to orbit around Earth.
Yeah.
What's your latest advice on the timeline for that?
It's looking promising for us to have an orbital launch attempt in a few months. We're actually integrating we'll be integrating the engines booster for the first orbital flight starting in about a week or two. The launch complex itself is ready to go. So assuming we get regulatory approval, I think we could have an orbital launch attempt within a few months.
And a radical new technology like this, presumably there is real risk on those early attempts.
Like the joke I make all the time is that excitement is guaranteed. Success is not guaranteed, but excitement certainly is.
But the last I saw in your timeline, you've slightly put back the expected date for the first human on Mars.
We have built a production system for Starship, so we're working with making a lot of ships and boosters.
How many plans do you have?
Well, we're currently expecting to make a booster and a ship roughly initially roughly every couple months, and then we'll be like next year, one every month. So giant rockets, but a lot of. Just in terms of talking in terms of rough orders of magnitude, in order to create a self-sustaining city on Mars, I think we'll need something in order of 1,000 ships. And we just need a Helen or Sparta, I guess, on Mars.
this is not in most people's heads.
The planet that launches 1,000 ships.
That's nice. But this is not in most people's heads, this picture that you have in your mind. So there's basically a two-year window. You can only really fly to Mars every 2 years.
Yeah.
You are picturing that during the 2030s, every couple of years, something like 1,000 starships take off, each containing 100 or more.
Yes.
I mean, that picture is just completely mind-blowing.
Yeah.
That sense of this armada of humans going
to... Yeah, like Battlestar Galactica, the fleet of the parts.
And you think that it can basically be funded by people spending maybe $200,000 on a ticket to Mars? Is that price about where it has been?
Well, I think what's required in order to get enough people and enough cargo to Mars to build a self-sustaining city. And it's where you have intersection sets of people who want to go, because I think only a small percentage of humanity who want to go, and can afford to go or get sponsorship in some manner. That intersection of sets needs to be among the people or something like that. And so it's what can a million people afford or get sponsorship for, or some good government support for it, but I think at the point at which you say, okay, like if moving to Mars costs, why does it take $100,000, then I think almost anyone can work and save up and eventually have $100,000 to be able to go to Mars. We want to make it available to anyone who wants to go.
Yeah.
So it's very important to emphasize that Mars, especially in the beginning, will not be luxurious. It will be dangerous, cramped, difficult, hard work. It's kind of like that Shackleton app going to the Antarctic, which I think is actually not real, but it sounds real and it's cool. It's sort of like the sales pitch for going to Mars is it's dangerous, it's cramped, might not make it back, it's difficult, it's hard work. That's the sales pitch.
But you will make history.
Yeah. But it'll be glorious.
Right. Oh, so on that kind of launch rate you're talking about, over 2 decades you could get beyond a million people to Mars. Whose city is it? Is it NASA's city? Is it SpaceX's city?
It's the people of Mars' city. The reason for this, I mean, I have to why do this thing? I think this is important for maximizing the possible lifespan of humanity and consciousness. Human civilization could come to an end for external reasons like giant meteor or super volcanoes or extreme climate change or global greed, any one of a number of reasons. The probable lifespan of civilization consciousness as we know it, which we should really view as this very delicate thing, with a small candle in advanced darkness. That is what it means to be the case. Within this vast darkness of space, and this beautiful candle of consciousness that's only really come about after 4.5 billion years.
A lot of people will be inspired by that vision. And the reason you need a million people is because there has to be enough people there to do everything that you need to survive.
The critical threshold is if this ship from Earth stops coming for any reason, does the Mars city die out or not? And so we have past that. That's like, you know, people talk about like the sort of great cultures, the things that perhaps we talk about the Fermi paradox, and where the aliens come from. Maybe the aliens didn't always bring us great cultures that go into the past, and so they eventually just cease to exist. And one of the great cultures is the Fermi multiplex. So we want to pass that culture, I'll be long dead before this is I'd like to see us make great progress in this production.
Given how tortured the Earth is right now, how much people are up, shouldn't there be discussions going on with everyone who is doing that much to try to say, we've got a once in a civilization's chance to make some new rules? Should someone be trying to do those discussions to figure out what it means for us to be people of Mars and city?
Well, I think ultimately this will be up to the people of Mars to decide how they want to rethink society. Yet there's certainly a risk there, hopefully the people of Mars will be more enlightened and will not mean, I have some recommendations that I think should be a lot of interest in. But I'm more advocate for sort of a direct democracy and direct democracy. And I'm just not sure enough for people to understand. You know, it is harder to believe the words that I'm saying.
Coming back a bit nearer to that, I'd love to just talk about some of the other possibility space. Starship seems to have created.
Yeah.
So given suddenly we've got this ability to move 100 times plus into orbit.
Yeah.
So we've just launched the James Webb telescope, which is an incredible thing, unbelievable.
Yeah. So it's two decades. An exquisite piece of technology.
An exquisite piece of technology. But people spent 2 years trying to figure out how to fold up this thing. It's a 3-ton. It's a 3-ton telescope.
We can make it a lot easier if you've got more volume and mass.
Well, so let's ask a different question, which is what, how much more powerful a telescope could someone design based on using Starship?
I mean, roughly, I would say it's probably order of magnitude more efficient. About 100 times the cost of getting this far, which is roughly.
And what about other exploration through the sun system?
Europa.
Right. So there's an ocean there, right? Yeah. And what you really want to do is to drop a submarine into
the ocean. I mean, maybe there's like some squids of this ocean with a separate body. Civilization on the ice of Europa, that would be pretty interesting.
And then, if you could take a submarine to Europa and see some pictures of the same powered by a submarine, that would honestly be the happiest thing.
Pretty wild, yeah.
What other possibilities are out there? Like, it feels like if you're going to create 1,000 of these things, they can only fly to Mars every 2 years. What are they doing the rest of the time? It feels like there's this
right.
explosion of possibility that I don't think people are really thinking about.
I mean, I don't know. We've certainly got a long way to go. As you alluded to earlier, we're still have to get to orbit. And then after we get to orbit, we have to really prove out and refine holographically useful people. But I do think the result is really confident.
Do you ever wake up with fear that there's going to be this pendulum Hindenburg
moment? We've had many Hindenburg moments. Well, we've never had Hindenburg moments with people, which is very important. Big difference.
There is.
We've blown out quite a few rockets. There's a whole compilation online that we've put together. Sure, rockets are hard. And the sheer amount of energy going through rockets is above the line. Getting out of Earth's gravity well is difficult. We have a strong gravity and thick atmosphere. And Mars, which is less than 40% of, it's like 37% of Earth's gravity and thin atmosphere. The ship alone can go all the way from the surface of Mars to the surface of Earth. Whereas getting to Mars requires a giant booster and orbital refilling.
So I think more about this incredible array of things that you're involved in. I keep seeing the synergies between the other world, between, for example, the robots that are building for Tesla could possibly be pretty handy on Mars.
Sure.
There's sort of a dangerous world and so forth. And maybe there's a scenario where the city on Mars doesn't need any people, but needs half a million people, half a million robots.
Sure.
And what's possible? Maybe the Boring Company can play a role helping create some of those subterranean running spaces that you might need.
Yeah.
Back on planet Earth, it seems like a partnership between Boring Company and Tesla could offer an unbelievable feel to a city. Say, we will create a 3D network of tunnels populated by robot taxis that will offer fast, low-cost transport to anyone. You know, full self-driving may or may not be done this year. And in some cities, like some like Mumbai, I suspect we'll be for a decade.
Some places are more challenging than others.
But today, with what you've got, you've got a 3D network of tunnels under.
Oh, if it's just in a tunnel, that's a solved problem.
And except full self-driving is a solved problem. So to me, there's amazing synergy there. With Starship, which I want to talk about, by 2028, having from city to city, you know, transport on planet
Earth. This is a real possibility. The fastest way to get from one place to the other one, it's long distance, is a rocket. It's basically an ICBM.
Right.
But
it has to land.
Landing to be
because it's an ICBM, it has to land probably offshore.
Yes, it's loud.
So why not have a tunnel that then connects to the city and Neuralink, I mean, if you're going to go to Mars, having a telepathic connection with loved ones back home,
These are not intended to be connected, by the way. There certainly could be some synergies, yeah.
Surely there is a growing argument that you should actually put all these things together into one company. Just have a company devoted to creating fusion-based software and let 1,000 people come back.
I mean, it is tricky because Tesla is a publicly traded company and the investor base of Tesla and SpaceX, so they weren't Neuralink Neuralink are tiny companies.
The
audience may be. Yeah. Tesla's got 110,000 people. SpaceX, I think, has around 12,000 people. Boring Company and Neuralink are sort of under 200 people. So. They're little tiny companies, but they will probably get bigger in the future. They will get bigger in the future. It's not that easy to sort of combine these things.
Traditionally, you've said that the SpaceX, especially, you wouldn't want to public because public investors wouldn't support the craziness of the idea of going to Mars or whatever.
Yeah. Making life multi-planetary is outside of the normal time horizon of multi-planets.
Say the least. I think something needs to change, though. What's changed is that Tesla is now so powerful and so big and throws up so much cash that you actually could connect with us and just tell the public that X billion dollars a year, whatever your number is, will be diverted into the Mars mission. I suspect you've got massive interest in that company, and it might unlock a lot more possibilities.
Yeah, we'd like to give public access to ownership of SpaceX. The overhead associated with the company is high. A public company, you're just constantly sued. It does occupy a fair price of time effort to deal with those things.
Right. But you still only have one public company would be bigger and have more things going on, but instead of being on four boards, you'd be on one.
I'm actually not even on the Neuralink Boring Company board. Yeah, and I don't really attend the SpaceX board meetings. We only have two a year, and I just stop by and chat for an hour. The board overhead for a public company is much higher.
Right. I think some investors would worry about how your time is being spent, and they might be excited by it. I just woke up the other day thinking just there's so many ways in which these things connect and you know the notion, the simplicity of that mission, building a future that is worth getting excited about, might appeal to an awful lot of people. Elon, you are reported by Forbes and everyone else as now in the world's richest person.
That's not a sovereign. You know, I think it's fair to say that, somebody is like the king of the back row,
So that it's just harder to measure. But what people do, so $300 billion, I mean, your net worth on any given day is rising or falling by several billion dollars. How insane is that?
Yeah.
And how do you handle that psychologically, right? Yeah, on, and then you keep them low.
I don't think about that too much. The thing that is actually more difficult and that does make sleeping difficult is that every good hour or even minute of thinking about Tesla and SpaceX has such a big effect on the company that I really try to work as much as possible to the edge of sanity, basically. because the Tesla's getting to the point where we'll get to the point later this year where every high quality unit of thinking is $1 million to get. So which is insane. The basic, Tesla's doing $2 billion let's say it's a week or $1 million a day. So maybe
if you can change that by 5% in an hour's brainstorm, that's pretty valuable. That's a pretty valuable hour.
I mean, there are many instances where I was able to improve the national economy by $100 million in a half hour.
There are many other people out there who can't stand this world of being in this act. They are hugely offended by the notion that an individual can have the same wealth as, say, a billion or more of the world's poorest people.
If they examine I think there's some axiomatic flaws that are leading to them to that conclusion. It would be very problematic if I was consuming billions of dollars a year in personal consumption. But that is not the case. In fact, I don't even own a home. I'm literally staying at friends' places. If I travel to the Bay Area, where most of the tough engineering is, I stay in my... I basically rotate through friends' spare bedrooms. I don't have a yacht. I really don't take vacations. It's not as though there's that my personal consumption is high. The one exception is a plane, but if I don't use a plane, then I have less hours to work.
I personally think you have shown that you are mostly driven by a really quite a deep sense of moral purpose. Your attempts to solve the climate problem have been as powerful as anyone else in the family that I'm aware of. And I actually can't understand, personally I can't understand the fact that you get all this criticism from the left about, oh my God, you're so rich, that's disgusting. When climate is their issue, philanthropy is a topic that some people go into. Philanthropy is a hard topic. Like, how do you think about that?
I think if you care about the reality of purpose instead of the perception of it, then philanthropy is extremely SpaceX, Tesla, they are philanthropy. If you say philanthropy is love of humanity, they are philanthropy. Tesla is accelerating sustainable energy. This is a love of full anthropy. SpaceX is trying to ensure the long-term survival of humanity and the long-term species. This is love of humanity. Neuralink is to help solve brain injuries and sectors to AI, love of humanity. Boring Company is trying to solve traffic, which is health for most people, and that also is not community.
How upsetting is it to you to hear this constant drumbeat of billionaires, my God, Elon Musk, oh my God, like, is it, do you just shrug that off, or does it think it actually hurt?
I mean, at this point, it's water effect back.
You know, I'd like to, as we wrap up now, just pull the camera back and just think, you're a father now, seven kids, and
well, I'm trying to set a good example, because the birth rate on Earth is so low that we're facing civilization collapse unless the birth rate returns to a sustainable level.
Yeah, you put that a lot, the population is a big problem, and we
yes.
People don't understand.
Population collapse is one of the biggest threats to the future of the next civilization. And that is what it does.
What drives you on a day-to-day basis to do what you do?
I guess I really want to make sure that there's a good future for humanity, and that we're on a path to understanding the nature of the universe, meaning of life, why are we here, how to get here. And in order to understand the nature of the universe and all these fundamental questions, we must expand the scope and scale of consciousness. certainly it must not diminish and grow out, for we will be pursuing the work of the state. So I would say I'm motivated by curiosity and impact, just a desire to think about the future and not be sad.
And are you? Are you not sad?
I'm sometimes sad. I'm feeling, I guess, well, to be optimistic about the future these days. There are certainly some big risks that one of the cases, I think the population collapse is a really big deal. I wish more people would be proud. The birth rate is far below what is needed to sustain civilization. Action on climate sustainability, which is being done, then we need to secure the future of consciousness by getting up with species. We need to address it's important to take whatever actions we can think of to address the existential risks that the future of consciousness.
There's a whole generation coming through who seem really sad about the future. Mm-hmm. What would you say to them?
Well, I think if you want the future to be good, you must make it so.
Thank you for all this time. That's a beautiful place. And thanks for all that you're doing.